in front of you today, we will hear from children, adults, and families, that particular budget within the Department of Human Services. And that is about 23% of the department's budget, so a significant but not the largest piece. In terms of paperwork, you had received the Department of Human Services binder earlier. In front of you, you have their ways and means presentation, and that can go in the tab. Let me find the appropriate tab. There's a yellow tab behind the agency overview that says children, adults, and families, and then a blue tab behind that that says Phase 1 CAF overview and priorities.
Morning.
So if you put that either in front of or behind that in terms of the presentation material, then you'll be on track. And then there is a one-page paper, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. This is a replacement page for the first page in the appendices. So, again, in the yellow CAF section in the appendices, right before the red Phase 2 documentation, page 1.
Which one goes there?
The Temporary Assistance to Needy Family page.
It's in the
this
yellow.
This is to get you all ready to go. And you can throw away the page that's in there or mark through it or whatever, so you know which one is the current one. And I'll come through and check all your binders afterwards.
Yes.
Make sure that you follow the instructions.
Please check my binder afterwards.
Okay. And then the only other point I would make, I mentioned this is children, adults, and families. We will be on this particular program area Monday through Thursday of this week. Then next week we begin the health services program area. So we have 4 days to move through this information, cover their priority lists, and reduction options.
Good morning.
So,
good morning, Doc. How are you doing?
Hello, how are you?
Thank you.
Okay.
By the way, committee members, I've asked that Ramona and the others will rearrange their budget of time so that on Thursday, instead of a half an hour to deal with priorities and proposed cuts, 10%, and all of those reductions, that we have an hour and a half on Thursday. And so the presentations will be finished by 9:30 on Thursday. That'll give us an hour and a half to go into more detail into the proposals as far as where, if we have to make reductions, where they would come from and what the priorities are. And so we'll be asking, you know, more in-depth questions during that time as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're ready to begin. If we could have our Assistant DHS Director for Children, Adults, and Families, Ramona Foley and Jim Neely. We turn the time over to you.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm Assistant Director at DHS over an area called Children, Adults, and Families. In terms of our mission of this particular area, and a lot of people look at that title and say, Children, Adults, and Families, what else is there? Certainly we serve multiple groups, many families, but we also serve individual children and individual adults who are receiving benefits such as the food stamp program. So these three former divisions are now in Children, Adults, and Families. The old Adults and Family Services, which was AFS, the Children's Division, which was CSD, SOSCF, for a period of years, and vocational rehabilitation. Our mission is to improve family capacity so that families can be self-sustaining and at the same time can provide safety and permanency for their children. And secondly, through the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, our agency assists Oregonians who have disabilities in helping them to achieve and maintain employment and independence. We have multiple goals within Children, Adults, and Families. If you're looking at page 1 of the document, you'll see that we help people find and keep jobs and also help them advance to better employment. We increase competitive job placements and increase wages earned for persons with disabilities. We expand program partnerships and seek to increase cultural competence of our staff. We provide accurate, timely benefits that support Oregonians as they work towards family stability and economic independence.
Okay, just a moment. Senator?
Can you help me find page one?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Ramona's referring to page one of the original information in your binder, the overview information, and I just had you place this either before or after it in your binder. So she's working from the original material in the binder initially.
We got a new page one.
Okay. Sorry about that. We also, other goals are to help prevent the need for public assistance in future generations of families who are receiving temporary assistance to needy families, helping to protect children and promoting child safety in the child's home, helping children who are unable to live safely in their own homes to live in other settings where they will be safe and have permanent families. As Director Weeks mentioned last Thursday, in 2001, the legislature passed House Bill 2294 and allowed the Department of Human Services to integrate policy and program functions from former divisions that were within the department. And I've named those three divisions that came together to become Children, Adults, and Families. So our role is to coordinate the child welfare programs of protective services, out-of-home care and adoptions, the self-sufficiency programs of temporary assistance to needy families known as TANF, Job Opportunity and Basic Skills Program, known as JOBS, food stamps, prevention services, employment-related daycare, emergency assistance services, Medicaid eligibility, and the refugee program. In the early reorganization, field services were known as community human services, and for a period of about 2 years, the field structure was separate from the program and policies of children, adults, and families. We had a great deal of feedback on that particular issue and from some members of this current committee. And in January of 2003, the field services section for children, adults, and families was realigned with program and policy, creating a single cluster. And this has served to enhance our communication across the programs and with the field and to promote efficiency in administration. Initially, seniors and people with disabilities, their field structure remained as part of children, adults, and families. In October of 2003, the field services for seniors and people with disabilities was reassigned to the seniors and people with disabilities policy cluster. So that was realigned as well. When CAF policy and the field were realigned, the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services was reassigned from the former field structure. It at one time had been under Community Human Services, and it was moved back over to Children, Adults, and Families to the policy group. The uniqueness about the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation is that the federal law requires that it remain intact as one entity in the organization. And so the field structure for vocational rehabilitation reports directly to Stephanie Parrish Taylor's staff in central office as part of the policy cluster. And in a while we will show you a document that reflects the structure of the organization as it currently is. A few comments as we talk about briefly about the program summary, the programs that we currently operate in children, adults, and families. You'll hear a range of services that are offered, and I think of these services from the least intrusive to the most intrusive services. Least intrusive services are those services that families or individuals actually walk into the office and apply for, or there's some outreach in which they can apply for those services. So self-sufficiency services and vocational rehabilitation services are examples of services that people actually can apply for, so we consider those voluntary services, and they're based on individuals being eligible to receive a particular service. That's contrasted with child welfare services, which are for the most part not considered voluntary services because the state law and the federal law allows the government to intervene at a certain point if children are unsafe. And so when we talk about the service array, you will hear about services that are considered involuntary services, services that families must access in order to remain safe parents for their children. There's more flexibility, of course, in the services when individuals walk in and apply, so that if you're doing case planning with someone who's receiving TANF, for example, there's an amount of creativity you might have in helping that individual seek employment. This, again, is contrasted to the child welfare set of services, which are fairly heavily prescribed by both federal and state law. And, of course, the reason for that being what hangs in the balance whenever the state does intervene in a family and determines through the court system that children can no longer remain in that family. Aligning these services has given us a wonderful opportunity in the state of Oregon, and I would say it's a unique opportunity. Most other states do not have the kind of alignment we have here, and that alignment allows us to treat our self-sufficiency programs as family preservation programs. There are things when families come in to apply for assistance. If you notice problems, and an example of that is if you have a parent who is applying for TANF, for temporary assistance for needy families, because they want to go to work. If that person has a drug problem, it is quite likely that that drug problem may also present a problem in them being able to parent children. And so by aligning these programs, we are hoping to see also efficiencies in how we work with families and how we deal with their problems. And Jim Neely will now talk very briefly about the program summary for self-sufficiency programs.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy for Field Services within Children, Adults, and Families. And as Ramona mentioned, I'll just do a quick recap of the programs that we consider in the self-sufficiency group. These are programs that most of you are familiar with in the old days, having been under Adult and Family Services Division. The one probably that most people know about, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or the TANF program, it's a program that replaced aid-dependent children in 1996 with federal welfare reform. And aid-dependent children, and now TANF is what most people think of as the welfare program. It's a program of cash assistance for families with dependent children. In 1996, that program moved from a matching program where the state had a particular general fund match, and it was then matched by federal dollars, to a block grant program where we still have a requirement to put a particular amount of general fund in, but we get a single amount and have since 1996 from the federal government in terms of that block grant. TANF was due to be reauthorized in 2003. It has not been. They have continued to sort of push it along with a series of continuing resolutions. They're, I think, looking perhaps as early as this spring, taking up TANF reauthorization. Part of the...
Senator Wesson. Jim, do you expect a reduction in... I mean, they've done this nine times now. They can't make up their mind as to what they really want to do. What do you expect the upshot will be, hopefully as early as this spring?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, I always hesitate to guess what Congress is going to
We're
do for us.
For a gut feeling guess.
My gut feeling is that they will not reduce the block grant amount. On the other side of that, they are very likely to give us considerably more regulation in terms of the jobs program and how we have to operate the jobs program, and I think that will be problematic for us.
I could say that the President apparently released his budget this morning. I didn't get a chance to go over it yet because I wanted to see what his proposals were, which certainly could be a lot different than what Congress would actually end up with. But from the State of the Union address, he's looking at reductions. We'll just have to wait and see how they come down.
You haven't read the entire President's budget yet this morning, Mr. Chair?
No, but I thought you might give us a summary.
Yeah.
Just those related.
There's
to
a three-hour time difference. You've had an opportunity.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
think about that 3 hours.
It's only, what's about 10,000 pages or something? I mean,
well, we'll work on being more diligent from this end. Would you please continue?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The jobs program, which actually stands for Jobs Opportunity and Basic Skill Program, is actually part of the TANF program, and it's the piece of the program that helps us move folks from public assistance to employment. And as I mentioned, this is the piece of the TANF program that is most likely to be affected by federal reauthorization. The proposals that we have seen, actually starting from a couple of years ago in terms of what was proposed for reauthorization but never acted on, are very much more restrictive in terms of what counts as participation in the jobs program, and the federal requirements for the state to continue to receive its block grant depends on this participation rate. So we continue to work with our delegation to make sure that we have the flexibility that we think we need to get folks from public assistance to employment. Emergency assistance provides short-term cash assistance to help low-income families with emergency needs. In 1997, prior to 1997, there was a single emergency assistance program. At that point, it actually became two separate programs, one the basic emergency assistance program and the other emergency assistance for domestic violence survivors. Ballot Measure 30 caused the basic emergency assistance program to be disappropriated, but we still operate the domestic violence emergency assistance program. Employment-related daycare is another program that we operate that is designed to work in conjunction with temporary assistance to needy families. While someone is receiving TANF benefits and looking for work or getting ready for work, if they have child care needs, as they often do, the jobs program takes care of that child care need in its entirety. When they actually get a job and leave the TANF program, but still have a child care need, they move to the employment-related daycare program. And the biggest difference for them at that point is that there is a copay that they have to make once they become employed that's on a sliding scale based on their income. And you'll hear later today a little bit about a little bit more about that program. The food stamp program is actually our largest program, and it's a program to provide food benefits to low-income households. Prior to 1997, we actually mailed out food stamp coupons to folks to use around the state. These were actually an alternate currency that were printed by a secure government printing office and shipped to the state in armored semis. We have moved to a little bit more modern technology with the Oregon Trail Card, electronic benefit transfer system. And currently that system transacts about $1.3 million a day in food stamp benefits in Oregon. We use about $38 million a month currently in federal food stamp benefits. The benefits themselves are entirely federally funded. The administration is split about 50-50 between the state and the federal government. There are currently about 430,000 persons in Oregon receiving food stamp benefits as of December. Prevention services provide support to local communities through teen pregnancy prevention services and community safety net. And the refugee program assists refugees to successfully resettle and provides a similar array of services to what the TANF and jobs program provide. And these are specifically for individuals who have gotten refugee status through the State Department.
Mr. Chair, question. Because they were passed out, the poverty guidelines. Are the poverty guidelines the same for food stamps? Are they all, as well as other services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, while the guidelines are the same, the percent of poverty that applies to eligibility for all these programs is different in almost every case. For instance, employment-related daycare is typically about 150% of poverty, food stamps 185%, TANF actually a much smaller percent of poverty in terms of basic eligibility.
Mr. Chair, this was a nice document, but I think it might be awful helpful for some of the other categories, and then it puts it all in context.
Okay. Actually, I had my LA do this document just so that we could easily look down at and see what the incomes would be at the different rates. But I agree. Would you help arrange for us to have a list of programs and what the percentages are so that we can know where they fit in? Thank you.
Okay, Ramona?
That's a nice segue to talk briefly about the child welfare programs, in that one of the underlying tenets is that there's not an eligibility factor in terms of child welfare services, so the poverty level doesn't relate directly to whether or not families qualify for child welfare services. There are several tenets that underlie our child welfare programs in this state and across this country. One is that children grow best if they are within their families. That we very much support that concept. If birth parents are unable to care for their children, then Oregon has a strong commitment to looking at extended family as to whether or not extended family can supplant what it is that's not there in that birth family. Third, when children are not safe and government must intervene, government must be able to do that immediately, and it must be able to do it with precision. I mentioned earlier the prescriptive nature of child welfare, and it is because of the seriousness of the outcomes. The decisions that are made in child welfare every day often are traumatic for families. They may be traumatic even if it's simply going out on a visit for child abuse or neglect reporting. Many families will benefit from the services offered by the state and through private providers, and so most children who are reported as abused or neglected, even if the case is substantiated, most children will not have to be removed from their homes. Of those children who have to be removed because they can't be safe within their families, the majority of those children will be returned home at some point. And as we get into these program descriptions, you'll be given some numbers about the size of child protective services in foster care and adoption. And then also, if parents can't be rehabilitated, if they can't provide safely for their children, then the state has an obligation to seek other families who might be able to provide permanent homes for those children. And an interesting thing that's happened after the Adoption and Safe Families Act that Congress passed in 1997 is that we currently now have more children on adoption assistance in this state than we have in the foster care system. This is a good thing. It's also a budget driver, and we'll talk about that, I think, in a couple of weeks when we get into some of the more details about some of the things driving our budget at this point. Child welfare, as I said, includes child protective services. That's the abuse and neglect referral system, how we handle reports of children 0 to 18 when calls come in. It's in the neighborhood now of about 46,000 calls each year. Those are not unduplicated calls. Some of those calls are made around the same incident. Some of those calls are made on the same family. The system has checks and balances in it. We have multidisciplinary teams in every county in the state. We also work very closely with law enforcement, work closely with the judicial system, with judges. The out-of-home care program, also known as foster care, serves over 13,000 children in any calendar year, and on any date, there's about 7,400 children in out-of-home care in the state of Oregon. These children have come into care because they could not be safely maintained within their own families. And about a third of our children still are placed with relatives when they have to come into foster care. So we're able to use family members that the children already know. And then adoption services includes both adoptions and guardianships. And I indicated earlier that we've done a good job in this state in terms of moving children for whom adoption is appropriate into adoptive placements. We'll be sharing with you all some of the measurements that we use to see how well we're doing in that compared to other states across the country.
I'm looking forward to that. And I'm also looking forward to, as you say, there's a cost driver with adoptive assistance, and I've seen that that has gone up substantially in recent years. And as an adoptive parent, and knowing many that are, I'm interested in knowing why there should be such an increase in subsidization for children that have been brought into homes through adoption, since they're no longer foster children and they now are part of a family.
Yeah.
But we can talk about that.
Mr. Chair, question. Is there a line item in your budget that where you pay for the assessment activity for when you're doing abuse and neglect that's outside the agency?
Chair Richardson and Senator Winters, that item is in the Child Protective Services program area, and it is under contract with the assessment centers around the state. Now, CAMI, and I'm going to fail this one, CAMI stands for the...
Enough?
It's handled by the Department of Justice. We don't have.
I believe it's Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention or something.
I believe it is too. That
we'll be
actually
on this later.
I think that directly is involved with those contracts, but we do have some funding in our budget to access that service.
Would you delineate that for me of what's being paid out of Child and Family Services, and because I'm on both committees, and I want to see what's happening in both places.
Great.
Back Chair to Richardson and Senator Winters, we can certainly do that.
Okay, that will certainly be more in-depth than that in Phase 2, but we'd like to have that information, and would you also provide it for the entire committee?
We will. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Baker.
Just a process question. Mr. Chair, well, you were kind enough to meet with me last week, and we went over some of these issues for about an hour, and I appreciate that conversation very much, the time it took. What is the plan for really, I mean, this agency's key marker for me is child safety. Getting kids back in families that are safe and getting them out of families that we can't help be safe. Is there a plan here that we're going to sit down and have an opportunity in this community to speak to that for an hour, hour and a half somewhere in the presentation before we get to Phase 2, or is it after Phase 2? And the reason I ask that is setting those priorities financially, it's important, at least for me, to hear more about what we started that conversation about, where those monies are going, what kind of progress is being made or not being made. So what was your thinking on when we might have an opportunity? I don't want to take time now to think about a lot.
That's good to get this clear for the entire committee. The co-chairs have asked that the Phase 1 be an overview plus information that we have in the books, plus if there are specific areas that we want to address, that we have asked for that to be addressed, but it can be done through written form. In other words, if you made a list of questions, we all would like to benefit from detailed answers. Then the co-chairs will meet with the sub-chairs after Phase 1, discuss kind of tentative ideas of where things may be going, and then Phase 2, we drill down and check into detailed specifics on numbers. This is the first time it's being done this way, so there's going to be some adjustments. But if there are specific areas that you really would like to have answers to, we don't have time to do that during Phase 1.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I think I'll do some drilling down outside this committee and then bring it back.
Yeah, if you could provide that.
That would probably be the best way to go.
Appreciate that.
Ramona, I look forward to seeing you later. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Later this week, you'll hear from Stephanie Parrish-Taylor, who's the administrator of the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, describe in more detail the four programs that fit under OVRS. Those include what most people think of when they think of voc rehab services as basic rehab services, a program designed to assist individuals to obtain employment. About 97% of all clients of voc rehab currently meet the federal definition for persons that have severe disabilities. And a typical client, and you'll hear more about this as well, has multiple disability and complex disability issues to deal with. Services include counseling, vocational training, job placement, and support services. Second, the Youth Transition Program provides counseling and support services to help youth move from disabled youth to move from school to the world of work. And OVRS contracts with more than 40 school districts and community colleges around the state to coordinate and provide those services with voc rehab staff.
Jim, would you take a second? You said 97%, and I didn't catch what the 97% was.
97% of the current clients of vocational rehabilitation services meet the definition for severe disability, the federal definition for severe disability. The point I'm trying to make there is that the folks that are using voc rehab services often have very significant disability issues and very often complex issues to deal with.
And the other 3% are just not severe?
Less severely disabled.
Okay, thank you. It should be all one page.
Number three, the Supported Employment Services Program serves individuals with significant disabilities who can obtain employment but often need supportive services to maintain that employment. Some of those services are provided on a time-limited basis through voc rehab early on, and then they coordinate with other community providers for ongoing services. And finally, the Independent Living Program assists individuals with significant disabilities to maintain and increase their independence both at home and on the work site while they're employed. And these services are often provided through community-based nonprofits identified as Centers for Independent Living. So those are the VR programs.
And then on page 7, if you're following along in the text, is the organizational chart for children, adults, and families, in which you see my name there as assistant director. And then you see two deputies below there. One is Jim Neely, To my right, you've already met Jim, and Jim actually has the responsibility for the 16 service delivery areas out in the field. And then I have the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, which is, as I said, a distinct office where direct supervision of the line staff happens through their central office. And then we have the program areas under Deputy Mickey Cerise, and those program areas that you will be hearing from now in the next couple of days, you see listed there. One of the things in the upper right-hand corner, you see the word advisory groups. I wanted to stress that we, I think, make very good use of advisory groups in this state. And we, the three that I would call your attention to is the Family Services Review Commission, which those are gubernatorial appointees to that commission, and they review our self-sufficiency programs. Then we have the Child Welfare Advisory Committee, which is a statutorily required committee with 21 members. And those individuals meet every other month, and they also give us excellent advice on how we are doing in child welfare and things that we need to be considering. And then thirdly, we have a state rehabilitation council. And in addition to being giving us advice, it also is seen as a policy partner to vocational rehabilitation. And I've been able to attend all three of these different committees, and I do think the quality of what we receive from those committees is really outstanding. So I wanted to mention that as we go forward. I think next we're going to be joined by Marge Reinhart.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marge Reinhart. I am the administrator for self-sufficiency programs within Children, Adults, and Families. I am, Jim is taller than I am. I'm going to be talking with you this morning about a number of programs that are under the Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs. The first of those is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, and its employment component, the JOBS Program. These are listed consecutively in your materials. I'm going to be talking about them together in this phase because they are, with respect to the history and the performance, they are intricately tied together. The other thing I would point out is you had asked a number of questions. I am hoping that I can address those as I go through, and I will try to make notes of where I have done that. If I miss any, please be sure and let me know. Jim mentioned the TANF program, and is that, may I refer to it as TANF now that it, is it clear?
That'll be fine.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The TANF program has undergone a number of evolutions over the last 15 or so years, beginning with the Family Support Act, in which Oregon began to offer case management and a more flexible array of jobs program services. That was in 1990, through the Temporary Assistance for Needy Block Grant, and at the same time the implementation of the Oregon Option Waivers. Those really gave us, as I think most of you know, some expanded flexibility that we have been able to use over the last several years to help our clients get the services that they need in order to move along towards self-sufficiency. You had asked a question regarding the status of our waiver as it related to one of the performance measures. As Jim mentioned, we have been in close contact with the congressional delegation and through the governor's office to talk with them about the needs of the success of Oregon's program and the needs of the program in reauthorization. We also have received assurances from Health and Human Services that Oregon's program, we are not risking putting Oregon at any kind of a risk at this point by continuing to operate using our waivers. So with respect to the flexibility in the program and the components that we offer and the time limits, which was the specific question you had, we are continuing to operate as though our waivers are in place. As Jim mentioned, it would appear this may be the session in which reauthorization really does happen, and could be sooner rather than later. The JOBS program is the component of...
Can I interrupt just for a moment?
Yes.
Are you leaving TANF?
I'm sorry. Well, yes, I moved. Yes.
Okay. A couple of questions. One, we were told earlier that to qualify for TANF,
Yeah. In Oregon, it's 185% of federal poverty level, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I was going to come back. Yes, I can move into the eligibility pieces now. That'd be fine. And then move on to jobs.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, to qualify for TANF, the initial, and you do have, I appreciate your staff providing you with some additional information in the appendix, in the CAF appendix. On the second page, you do have the poverty level at 100%, 155%, and 185%. We will get you the additional detail that will put some more context around that, but maybe for today's discussion, hopefully that will be helpful. The way the TANF program, there is what I guess would be sort of a first cut at eligibility for the TANF program. We call that the countable income limit. And that amount for a family of three is $616. So that after that is kind of the initial eligibility cut for TANF. If a family qualifies, a family of three does have a countable income limit of under that amount, and they would qualify for TANF, the actual grant amount for that family would be a maximum of $503. When we combine that with the an expected amount of food stamp benefits, it brings that family's income to about $900 a month. That is about 70% of the federal poverty level. And we will be getting you additional examples and details around that. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chair?
Well, it kind of does. I'm wondering, are all states at the same level? Is this a federal percent, 185, or is this a waiver for Oregon?
That the block grant, as I understand it, and I will clear, if this is incorrect, I will let you know, but I believe that income limits are left to the states to determine, so that the qualifying income limit and the benefit limits are something that our states are able to determine based on the block grant status of the program.
Because I'm seeing, just looking at a chart at 185%, I'm seeing that a family of four can earn over $2,900 a month and still qualify. And so I just wanted to see if that was a federal limit or a state limit. And if it is a state limit, then what is the federal limit? Is it 135% or 100%, or what is the required amount for the Fed?
I'm sorry. I believe I misunderstood your first statement, Mr. Chair. The 185% is not a limit for TANF. The TANF limit is significantly lower than that.
Okay. What I'm asking then, what is the federal TANF limit and what is Oregon's TANF limit?
The Oregon, and the one that I have for you now, and we will provide you with the additional information around the Oregon limits, the one that I can quote for you right now is the $616 for a family of three, and we can get the rest of that information for you. And I believe that there is not a federal income limit associated with the block granted of the TANF program.
Okay, Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, the purpose, unlike categorical grant, which is where the federal government then sets the specifications, under block grants to states, they're allowing states a certain amount of latitude and flexibility. So it may not necessarily, there may not be a floor or a ceiling from the feds, because they're allowing flexibility to look at their own states and then to determine at what level they want to fund various kinds of programs. It's true whether or not they're doing the level of jobs programs and some of those other issues, but that's the reason for, quote, block grant. There's kind of like this stand, like a format around it, but they let you fill in the detail.
Okay.
That's probably the easiest way to say it.
All right. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, the $616 income limit for the state of Oregon relative to federal poverty level is about 47%. So you could say our income limit at Oregon for TANF is 47% of the federal poverty level, as opposed to other programs which are at 100 or 150 or 185.
Well, I'm looking at a chart at 100% for a family of three, and it's showing 1,306. And so you're saying it's 100 and
the $616 would be about 47% of that 1,306. So $616 for a family of three is the maximum income they could have to qualify for TANF in Oregon.
Okay. I'd just like to have a chart then of various qualifications.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we will provide that for you, and thank you, Senator Winters, for clarifying for me. In terms of additional eligibility criteria for the TANF program, I wanted to, and this will address one of your other questions, and also talk a bit about the jobs program and its requirements. Within the temporary assistance for needy families, the tenet of this program is to provide financial assistance for needy children. With that in mind, there are a significant number, about 36% of Oregon's TANF recipients, where the parent is not included in the benefit group. Primarily, these are either situations where the parent is receiving Supplemental Security Income, SSI, or where the parent is caring for a child who is not his or her own, either a grandchild or a niece or nephew or another relative child who is not their own. That caseload has grown in Oregon, and as I say, at this point is now there are about 36% of our full caseload who are not, where the parent is not considered part of the benefit group. So in terms of the jobs program and its eligibility requirements, and this leads to one of your other questions around performance measures, nearly all of those people, aside from the 36% I just mentioned to you, are required to participate in the jobs program. Using our current caseload information, there are about 12,000 cases that who would be subject to jobs program participation because the parents are part of the benefit group. Of those, about 2,000 are exempt from participation. And those are generally, for a large majority of those, are women who are in their their last trimester of pregnancy or in their first 3 months postpartum. So we have that six-month window for pregnant women and new mothers to be exempted from the jobs program. So there are about 10,000 cases in which there is a person who is supposed to be participating in the jobs program activities. The jobs program is administered in Oregon through local contracts in each of our service delivery areas. Those contracts are with employment-related entities. Those are usually either Workforce Investment Act entities, community colleges, and or state employment departments. There are also, and they provide the bulk of the employment-specific related information. There are also locally a series of contracts that address some of those things that both Jim and I have mentioned around the flexible services that our families need to be able to enter the workforce, like drug and alcohol counseling and other sorts of activities. You had asked a question about the changes and modifications that we've made to the program. We will be talking quite a bit more about this in phase two, but in terms of just giving you a flavor of examples of things we've done, based on the economy and our client demographic, as well as in anticipation of reauthorization of the program, we are looking locally at doing many more workplace-focused type activities. And these are things like unsubsidized work experience in local sites where people can get some additional structure and support, to working with sheltered workshop organizations that provide some of those kinds of services. If you'd like some more information in this phase about the retooling, we can get into that. I think what I'd like to do is first of all talk just for a moment about our TANF caseload and then talk about some of our key performance outcomes. And I think that some of the pieces that I've shared with you, I may be able to clarify as we go through that. Last week in the overview, our director had shared this caseload chart with you, and I would call your attention to a couple of things. First of all, we obviously saw a dramatic decline in our caseload.
I'm going to ask a question that may make me sound like a real ogre, but as you spoke to it, I just listened to it, and this is probably coming out of my experience as a physician. Is it correct you told me that a TANF individual who's pregnant takes the last trimester of pregnancy off from being in a job search situation, then takes how much time off after delivery off?
The first 3 months.
My experience with the people who pay taxes to support this program, working women, which is the majority of women I see, work up to delivery, take 6 weeks off, and go back in the workforce. Is that a requirement by the federal government, or is that a state requirement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, that is, as Senator Winters elaborated for me, clarified for me, there are many parts of the TANF program at the federal level that are not mandated by the state. The federal requirements actually talk about looking about mothers being exempt for the first year after the child is born. The Oregon program does operate with, so it is a state, the answer to your question is that it's a state decision to use the 3 months. Now, I might also add that these are allowable exemptions. Not all of our clients take advantage of that, and particularly those who are postpartum, where we've been working with the family and have a case management relationship with the family, we do encourage that first 3 months be used for securing daycare, adequate daycare, researching and looking for daycare, beginning to do some of the preliminary pieces around returning to work.
Okay. I don't want to count Olaf here, if you know who he is, but I think you should maintain community standards in these programs. And I know I sound like a bad person saying this, but I'm not sure you're doing that. Okay, I mean, fair is fair.
Of course, the challenge also is that someone coming off of, after having a baby, who's on this program may be at an income level stream that is so low that they're going to then be using the ERDC stands for what?
Employment-related daycare.
Okay, employment-related daycare. And the cost, if you did all the math on it, they would be better off being with their child than paying for everything that it takes to go at it. So there's just a whole series of webs of consequences from the whole thing, but certainly...
I think when you add in everything to the program, food stamps, WIC, ERDC, OHP, and everything else, probably from the point of view of the patient, or the individual, it's better off not going back to work, but that's a problem in the system, not the problem with the patient.
Yeah, which is something that we also will be discussing
I don't mean to be harsh, but it just seems a little unfair to me. I know how hard women that I know that are raising children are working, and I know they look at these kind of things and they kind of go,
Your comment certainly goes to the fact that we have essentially politicized the whole system in that you either qualify or you disqualify, and if you qualify, you get a whole list of benefits, and if you make a little more than that and are disqualified, so now who wants to take that risk? And so we end up putting this glass ceiling over people that are in poverty. Representative Henson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In partial response to Senator Bates, the jobs programs are a lot of training programs, of reading programs, programs to develop skills. I think one of the reasons is that for that dropping or those time periods is you wouldn't want to start somebody on a program and then have it in the short term interrupted. And then, so if you're starting a program during the third trimester and then there's an interruption, it may not be productive in terms of the skills and stuff that were learned or not learned. The other one is oftentimes there's some other health things that
that sometimes can complicate the whole situation.
That's true.
Mr. I don't want to belabor. I think the only thing that my senator to my right is raising is that, you know, I think some of us went through some grueling times in talking about two measures that failed. And some of the comments that you receive out there from the general public is that sometimes the benefits that that they're paying for are greater than that which they, as a person who pays the bill. And I think when we're developing policy, whatever public policy that it is, that we have to be mindful of what the majority of individuals are having to do in the real world. I mean, I think that's the only thing that he was trying to say. And as policymakers, we have to be mindful of that. And I think there's always going to be some case or cases that fall outside of the norm.
Certainly.
And certainly that will happen, whether it's medical or for some whatever reasons. But part of the reasons behind block grant funding from the national level is to allow states those flexibilities to develop their programs with inside of their needs so that they're not being prescriptive from Washington, D.C. I just go back to so we can take and use that and craft what it is that we think is relevant for the state of Oregon.
Right. I just think that as we look at our criteria, one criteria we might add on relevant programs would be, are the benefits provided greater than those enjoyed by the taxpayers who pay for them?
That's my point.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I hope that the documents that we will prepare for you will help to show a deeper relation between all of the programs and their relationship to sort of the rest of the citizens of the state.
Thank you.
So, I wanted to talk just for a moment about the two key performance measures and a couple of the outcome measures that we use in the TANF and jobs program. The first of these is in your material. It is also part of the department annual performance report, and you have a slide so you can take your pick about how you would like to look at this one. This is the percent of TANF clients placed for whom employment is a goal. You had asked a question about that, a clarification regarding the data source, and thank you for pointing that out to us. The data source form is incorrect and has been since the beginning of that. We had changed that prior to what you're seeing in these documents. When I talked before about the percentage of people who are not subject to the jobs program, those people like grandparents caring for grandchildren and SSI recipients, we felt it was more reflective of our work in the jobs program and more useful to us in retooling the jobs program to have our success be measured against those people with whom we ought to be working. As you see, we have not met our targets. There are probably three key reasons that we believe this to be the case, and this runs true for, I think, most of the information regarding our TANF caseload. The first one you had raised in a question to us regarding the resources available to the jobs program. And I think that, yes, when, you know, any time that resources are removed from a program, it's reasonable to expect that there would be performance impacts. I guess what I would like to... Yes, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. When we're looking at this chart, are we to surmise that 10.5% of the people that receive TANF payments are the folks that are looking for a job?
No. About two-thirds of the people who receive TANF payments half to two-thirds are looking for a job. Between 10 and 12,000 people at any time are part of our jobs participant pool. What this is saying is that of those 10,000 or so, 8.7, 9.1, and 9.3% of those are placed in employment per month. And this is obviously quarterly, but it's a cumulative.
Follow up. If your mission is to improve family capacity to be self-sustaining, and out of the group that are participating to get a job, we're only getting 9 or 10%. Maybe I'm missing something, but that seems a long ways off the mark.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna. What that is saying is that out of that caseload in each month, that is the sort of rolling target that we are placing. So that of those 10, I'm trying to do math in my head, okay. But that we are at any given time placing about 8% of our families in jobs, presumably, and you'll see from our second performance measure, we are fairly successful in keeping them employed, and so it is a rolling target, or a rolling number of 8%. As that accumulates, then more of the low income people in Oregon who would qualify for TANF would be placed. Does that help clarify at all?
Chair.
I
had to look at this 3 times myself. I can vaguely remember from last time. I think this is what it means. If you have 100 people enrolled in TANF who are required to look for a job, about 8% of them each month actually get a job. And of that 8%, most of them keep that job for at least 18 months if you look at both of these things. And that's what this one says. The next question is, what percentage of people who are placed in TANF are asked to go look for work? And I think it's the majority, if I remember right. Is that correct?
It is around when, yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, when you remove those people that I talked, that 36%, then it is most everybody else.
So about 75% of the people who go into TANF are required to look for work each month, and about 8% of them actually get a job. But they stay on the job for about 18 months at least when you follow them. So that it's a rolling number, but you seem to be placing them for long term.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, that is correct, except it is not 75%. It is a lower number than that because about 36% are.
Okay.
So it's about two-thirds, slightly less than two-thirds.
Okay. Is that?
About 64%.
It does.
Does it make sense? I mean, you guys understand what they're doing?
No, I think it does, but it still points to if your main mission is to make families self-sustaining, in my mind, we're still missing the mark somehow.
If you promote that number out, it probably takes a year to place most people, or could be.
If
it's a rolling number.
An individual who's not getting assistance, you can't live for a year without getting a job.
It's some kind of a rolling number there. It's hard to follow.
A question I have is, as I look back at the prior chart, it says that the numbers are staying fairly current as far as the number of people participating. So that means I would assume that roughly you have the same number coming in each month as going out, or is this a seasonal thing?
Should be greater.
Mr. Chair, I think roughly that is true. I'd like to check that. There are some seasonalities to the TANF program. In terms of the statewide trends around seasonality and the ins and outs, let me check on that and get back to you.
Would you provide us with kind of a one-pager explaining how Oregon is making finding of employment the number one, such a high priority, since self-sufficiency implies being able to pay your own bills, and since having a job solves a whole series of human services problems, we would assume this is just a huge priority. I'd like to have us know what is being done. I'd like to know the number of employees that are directly related to finding employment, and how many people they work with. I'd like to know what the caseload is and that kind of thing, but not to take time here, but so we kind of get a sense of just, how we're fighting this battle to help unemployed people become employed.
It would be very helpful if you provide for us, particularly given the high unemployment rate in Oregon, and from a historic perspective, it's usually normal that if you have high unemployment, your caseloads go up. You're over on the other side. So if you provide us with, before we went into the downturn spiral, and I think it would be helpful for this committee to know what those numbers were, rather than dealing in percentages, because this is getting everybody confused. What were your case numbers then that were in TANF? and see if you have a decline in numbers or whether you're going to have a spike in individuals who are coming into your program. And then what is your success rate of getting those individuals employed? You might also overlay that with the issue of jobs and jobs plus, because we had two different jobs programs. That gives us a better understanding of what's working.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, in terms of that request, if we were, we would prepare that then similar in terms of looking at our total number of folks, which now is about 12,000 people who would be looking for work. Of those, we place 1,000 people a month, and we'd be you'd want that then to okay.
What was your number in 01?
And that's what I will have to get for you, but that's sort of a comparison. Of 12,000, we place 1,000 now. What was our percentage then? The other couple of comments that I would make regarding the performance measures and our outcomes related to both this measure and other measures. One of those is the changing in our client characteristics. Of those 12,000 people, many of those people come to us less prepared for work. They have a lack of education, learning disabilities, drug and alcohol issues, and some significant gaps in work history. That has people those characteristics of clients have caused us to make some changes in the programs, but they also, in addition to those characteristics being more profound, they are the economy, the general economic conditions now make folks with those characteristics less competitive for the kinds of work that they were able to get. So I think maybe Senator Winters having a comparison like that will be helpful to the committee, and we'll be sure and provide that for you.
The outcome or the performance measures, how many people get employed. And if we're looking from a standpoint of what's occurring in Oregon to either help them get employed or to hinder them from getting employed, I think that it's helpful for this committee.
Thank you.
Any other questions on that? Can I move to sort of the other performance measure that we use to gauge the effectiveness? And I think maybe this gets to a bit to some of your questions regarding the effectiveness of the program. We look not only at who we are able to place, but what happens to them later. And this slide shows the number of people who had were placed from the TANF caseload and are not on TANF 18 months later. We can't, in anticipation of a question, we can't accurately know that all of those people are working. We do, though, know that they are not on TANF now. And because we have not implemented time limits in Oregon as yet, we so that people aren't artificially, as it were, not back on TANF, then we continue to use this measure, and as you see, we remain over 90% of those families who are placed are not on TANF 18 months later.
Would you mind going into that just a little bit more detail? The 1996 legislation on the federal level was to implement temporary benefits and a change from entitlement program, and so that was the whole idea. Are you saying that Oregon, through its waivers or through the way that we have this plan organized, is not temporary, but that a person or family could remain on TANF?
A person, and that may be a bit of a misnomer, Mr. Chair, the way I may have misspoken a bit. Oregon has time limits, but the time limits take effect when a family is no longer participating in the jobs program. So as long as a family is working in a case management with their case manager and doing the jobs program activities that they've agreed to do, then the time limits are suspended.
Okay, would you also provide for us then a breakdown on length of time so that we can see, you know, longest, shortest, averages, but I'd like to see the whole bell curve so that we can get a sense of are there people that are no longer temporary but are really long, and then we, of course, like to know why would that happen.
Mr. Chair, could I ask for a clarification on that? Mm-hmm. Would you like that if we do that, should we include or exclude that 36% of the people for whom the JOBS program is not required, the grandparents caring for grandchildren and those?
Just mention it, and that would be excluded, but make sure that it's clear that it is and what the number is on that.
Okay.
Thank you. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Please continue.
Just another note on that. In terms of your question, when TANF is reauthorized and we do have time limits, we would obviously look to recalibrate this measure to take that into account. I wanted to talk just for a second about a couple of other outcome measures that we use within the JOBS program.
I'm still thinking about what you just said. When it's reauthorized, since we're still working on waivers, does that mean that it's different now? Or because of the lack of reauthorization, has that changed the way Oregon's plan functions?
Mr. Chair, it has not changed the... with respect to time limits, it has not changed the way we operate. We are continuing to suspend that time limit calculation during the time in which a person is participating in JOBS.
Okay, thank you.
The next one that we just wanted to talk about briefly is teen parents have been a critical focus for us as we've had to shift some resources to the adult program and the JOBS program. That has made it more difficult, but nationally, the number, percent of TANF temporary assistance for needy families who began as teen parents is quite remarkable. So we do want to continue our focus around keeping teen parents in school and or assuring that they've achieved their high school diploma. We remain at over 90% in that category as well. I wanted to call your attention to that as a part of the program. And then the final piece that I wanted to mention to you, is the hourly wage within the JOBS program. Representative Hanna had talked about self-sufficiency and moving people to self-sufficiency. That is one of the reasons that we do continue to track this as an outcome measure. As you see, we are continuing to place those 1,000 people or so a month at about a dollar above minimum wage, which does allow them with employment-related daycare or other supports to be reaching a higher level of self-sufficiency. That is, unless you have other questions, that is my presentation on TANF.
Senator Westland.
One slide back, the pregnant teens. What percent of that is the total female population in, hopefully, high school? Say we're reaching, 95%, 94%, 96%. What percent of that is the females enrolled in high school?
Mr. Chair.
How many teen mothers we got running around, or pregnant mothers we got running around in high school?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland.
The non-pregnant mothers?
Yeah.
You want actual numbers or
exactly right.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, I don't...
1,000 mothers in a given school, 1,000 females in high school, how many of them are pregnant?
That's a school.
Yeah,
school.
Sir, do you know that?
Very small
percent. Yeah. Mr. Neely says, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, a very small percent.
Mr. Chair, in terms of overall teen pregnancy rates, I think it's about 25 or fewer per 1,000, which would be for ages 15 to 17. So that would be about 2.5%. Now, that doesn't address whether they're in school or not in school, but it gives you a little bit of context.
Nor does it address the question of whether or not it is a good thing for pregnant girls to be in school and not having education in other ways since they're no longer typical teenagers. But that's a different issue.
All these males, men are talking about something that they haven't don't know how to carry.
Is there a concern about whether these young women are staying in school or not? I mean, that's a key question, whether they're getting their education. And
you have two questions there. One is, are they getting their education? Another, are they staying in school in a normal curriculum while they're pregnant or having little babies,
campus?
That is a key question.
Yeah, twofold. That's where I was going was, what's the percent of the whole, and given that percent, how disruptive is that to the other students?
Yeah.
And two, is that the best place for these women to get their educations, go on, get a job? I mean, honest question, I don't know the answer to those questions.
You know, it may be, Mr. Chair, since I know that in Salem we do have a school here, you might want to take members of this panel to visit Barbara Roberts School, which would give you some firsthand view, and also give this panel of the male species to be able to ask the question from the students and the young ladies of how it benefits or does not benefit them.
I just want you to know, during my married life, my wife's been pregnant 64 months. So over 5 years we've been through this.
Yeah, I think that's a very sexist comment.
Yeah, you do.
But she's true. We cannot know what it's like to carry this conversation.
Walking in one's moccasins sometimes give you a better understanding of what one may or may not be thinking. And so, and since this is very close down the street, it would be an opportunity, really, for individuals to go. Salem was one of the first communities to, in fact, I think we were the first to recognize this, and as a community, put our energies into dealing with and addressing this problem. So I would encourage you to go visit.
Thank you very much.
All right. I wanted to talk with you briefly about emergency assistance, which, as Jim pointed out a little while ago, is for DHS at this point is limited to temporary assistance for domestic violence survivors. The program at this point serves families, women primarily, I'm trying not to be sexist, but it is primarily women who are fleeing domestic violence situations. They can receive up to $1,200 during a 90-day period in order to assist with that. Generally, though, that is relocation costs or rent and utilities and sort of beginning a household-type cost. There are occasional exceptions to the to that 90-day window, and when we have those are staffed both locally and with our central office staff, and only about 4% of the people receive that additional payment.
4% of what number?
4% of, I knew you were going to ask that, and it ended up not on my list. Mr. Chair, 4% of in November, which was our last data, it was 4% of 634 cases.
Okay, thank you. In just a moment, Representative Hansen.
In the same area, some of the questions I'd like to pursue during the second phase, without going into your performance measure, but the performance measure is very broad in terms of all women and subject to domestic violence. Do you have any outcomes of your emergency assistant program in terms of what the percentage of women that participated in that are victims of additional domestic abuse, of that type of outcome specific to the your program? The other thing that I'd be very interested in seeing is of a chart that shows all of the different funding streams for domestic violence programs, not just within your department, but I know we've got a program within the Attorney General's office, mm-hmm. and there are some local programs, so that we can get a whole picture. The benchmark looks at the whole patterns of domestic violence. And I would like to see if there are any information in terms of outcomes available for all of those different programs that are involved with different funding streams, so we can get a sense of which are the programs that are most successful or less successful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I will look at what we have in terms of outcomes specific for the clients who receive temporary assistance for domestic violence survivors, and get you what we are able to do. One of the things, and you're right in terms of the performance measure and its broadness. This is a performance measure for the department. It is one that within children, adults, and families, we believe we are a feeder, if you will. We impact it. It is not a measure that we are solely responsible for many of the reasons that you have mentioned. We do, however, there are a couple of things that I think maybe address this where I think we do impact that. First of all, it's just the issuance of money, financial supports for victims to leave a violent situation and be able to stabilize their situation. The other speaks a bit to your coordination and your funding streams question. Part of the way that the program is managed includes a training and local collaboration component, so that within each of our local areas there is extensive training for our staff, so they are able to better identify domestic violence situations and work with families, but also work collaboratively with local domestic violence service providers, and often that includes victims assistance and some of the other programs that are parts of those other funding streams. But we will work on getting you that information.
Thank you.
And moving right along, the employment-related daycare program, which is known as ERDC. The ERDC is basically a program that provides supports to low-income families moving to self-sufficiency. It's obviously a critical part for us in helping clients move up that ladder of self-sufficiency, if you will. You had asked some questions about the market rate, and one of the foundations of our program in Oregon is operating without a waiting list. Oregon made a decision to serve more people to cast a wider net, if you will. The result, and about half the states, by the way, do have waiting lists. The other half operate without. The result of that, particularly in our economic times, is that our reimbursement rate and our market rate is lower than some of the other states. We currently pay, the program basically works by looking at income and against that income, determining how much of a daycare expense would be covered by a subsidy that we provide, and how much the family would be responsible for, which we refer to as the copay. The latest market rate survey, which was published last summer, showed that our rates are in the 21st percentile, meaning that 21% of all of the providers across Oregon charge less than what we pay. 79% charge more. So then using our market rate levels, then we calculate what the copay requirement is for that family. What this means for families is that the Oregon benchmark calls for families to pay 10% or less of their income in child care. Families receiving employment-related daycare will pay between 9% and a little over 20%, depending on their level of income and how much their copay amount is. So we need it for the very lowest income, but as people move up that income limit, they are paying up to 20% or slightly more of their income in daycare expenses.
Let me ask a question about eligibility on these programs. On everything you've discussed, each of the programs so far, is there a residency requirement? How long would they have to be in Oregon before they can apply for these benefits?
Mr. Chair, there are the residency requirement. There is a residency requirement for TANF and employment-related daycare, and it is. But there is not a time limit residency requirement. They need to be residents of Oregon, but they don't need to be here for a certain length of time. And I believe I'm going to have to check on domestic violence whether a person needs, because we do provide relocation costs, which would imply that the person will no longer be a resident of Oregon. But I'll have to check on that one for you to see if our eligibility criteria specifically says Oregon residents.
I would specifically like to have that address. I'd like to know on each of the programs. I'm interested in knowing what it takes to qualify. Oregon taxpayers are paying for this, and I mean, is it enough just to show up, get an apartment or get a motel, right, and then apply for the benefits, or is there a requirement that you be an Oregon resident for a period of time? And you're saying that so far on ERDC and on TANF, there is no time requirement for being a resident of Oregon?
There's no time requirement, no. But they must be a resident.
It might be well if that members have, where you have federal funds that drive some policy that takes place in Oregon. For example, I look at health care. Whether you're an Oregonian or not, and you show up in Oregon and you show up at the hospital, the federal policy drives whether or not you can treat that individual, and the federal policy says you cannot deny service because you're receiving federal funds. And so it would be well to know how much of the policy or the eligibility requirements is federally driven and not state.
Also, we get waivers, and so if we get waivers on amount, then can we not get waivers on portions of it? In other words, Medicaid requirements are meet federal requirement, but beyond Medicaid, then it's what we request as far as a waiver.
Where you have the statutory language, for example, the same as if you have Oregon statutory language, even if you request a waiver, your waiver cannot go outside the bounds of the law itself. And so it's, if the law says, the federal statute says that states, that hospitals, I know that one particularly because that's where a lot of our cost shift is taking place. Hospitals cannot, under certain acts, refuse service.
Right.
And so because they're receiving federal funds. And so it would be well to know, and if staff has time, to designate where federally you cannot change, even though we may want to.
No,
but as long as we receive those federal dollars, you must then comply with the federal law. And
all right, so what you're saying is that the federal government has certain requirements and that we can expand on those, but we can't be more restrictive than those, even for that part of the population that is above the Medicaid limits.
It'll vary, but in the case that you're, it could vary, but in the case where you're talking about particularly, in certain cases, I would say no. Where you've got the same as if Oregon statute defines specifically an element or area. The same is true with some of the Medicaid that we receive that's in federal statutes. And no waiver can tell you to go out.
I understand it. Okay.
No federal representative is going to tell you that he will give you, he or she, permission to violate the law.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Maybe the succinct way to say it is that the federal government sees several of these programs, TANF in particular, and Medicaid, as national programs, and that the state boundaries are not relevant to the administration of their national program. Therefore, transigency of citizens across state lines is not important to the implementation of their program.
I certainly see that. I guess my question is, like on the Oregon Health Plan, we have Medicaid. Medicaid is a federal program. It's a federal requirement. If Oregon decides that they want to have a population like the standard population that goes beyond Medicaid,
then it seems to me that we would have greater flexibility on what the requirements and eligibility requirements and so forth are, and I assume that we have that. My question was on a block grant from TANF, whether or not that same kind of flexibility would apply. Senator Bates.
I think you've answered the question. On TANF and probably food stamps, we're pretty locked into the food stamp program. It was almost 100% federal, and they set requirements, and those are the requirements that we're going to have the program. The Medicaid program is, because of waivers in almost half the states now, variable, and I think there's a few individuals out there who may be gaming the system by moving from state to state. Mm-hmm. I don't know that as a fact, but it's something we have to consider.
Certainly. Thank you. Representative Hamm. Or Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the reason why the federal government moved to that, if I remember back history-wise, of when you have situation of economic relocation, like the Dust Bowl during the 30s, the migration out of the South as the cotton industry and stuff changed, and there were some other reasons there. There's lots of reasons where, because of economic driven issues, people have to move. And if there's no way, if their benefits aren't portable, then you lock people living in an area where there's no way out, and yet no opportunities in those areas. We used to, I think, even have a situation that benefits were withheld on a county-to-county basis years ago, which would mean that if somebody needed to move to some place where there were, you know, was for more opportunity, they were locked into an area that had, like, the most dismal economy, and that was the reason why we migrated to this type of a system with relatively uniform benefits across the country.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Richardson, if I might contribute one thing on that. When TANF was first put in place and states began exercising their block grants, there was quickly noticed a variation in the amount of benefits. And one or two states, at least one I know, tried to create a residency requirement because they were afraid, because their benefits were higher, that they would become a magnet state and more families would be moving there for those benefits. As I recall, ultimately there was a constitutional issue about the residency, but we can go back and look at that and provide that as part of the answer, which would give you a national perspective on that issue.
Thank you very much.
I think with respect to employment-related daycare, the last thing I wanted to talk just a bit about is our administration and our cooperation with the child care division, and particularly with respect to our performance measure around the percent of clients, the percent of providers who receive an enhanced rate. The program, the child care division actually licenses the child care homes in the state, both family and center homes in the state. We work closely with them through DHS to apply to help our clients to at least meet the criteria, even if they don't want to be a licensed provider through the child care division. And that is essentially the definition of the quality child care rate. So locally, the child care division has a network of providers and trainers and educators and supporters who work closely with our staff and with our providers that we have through DHS to provide those training opportunities for providers. So basically what we're doing is at the local level working with them to encourage and promote and inform providers about the enhanced rate and the value that that rate has for them, both economically and in terms of providing quality care for the families we serve. So families who do not, a couple of clarifying points I just wanted to make, families who do not opt for, who are not part of that 25%, are not just sort of, you know, they have to meet a series of requirements as well. They need to pass a criminal record check and do some level of safety and health disclosure in order to receive any kind of payments from us. Then, as I say, we work locally to encourage people to take advantage of the training opportunities and then receive that enhanced rate.
Just so I can get for our committee a sense of how this kind of thing grows, would you give me a timeline say for the last 10 years, the number of employees that that you have that provide oversight, training, and all these other aspects for child care, and just you know what the costs are, so that we can get a sense to how that works.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just as a clarification, we can do that. Our staff do not provide the training that comes out of the employment department. They manage the child care. They are responsible for the child care division is a part of the employment department. We can work with them around that information, both at a local level.
All right.
Is that what it is that you're asking for?
Okay. You know, the phase one is as where as this develops is mm-hmm. for us to get an overview and to make requests that won't take a lot of time here at the dais, but that will allow us to review things so that when we go into phase two, we have greater knowledge and understanding and information. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just so you know, you asked for the last 10 years. I believe it was either 99 or what. It's been rather recently that we actually required certain requirements of providers through the employment division, so your data may not go back mm-hmm. 10 years. Just to put it in perspective, that includes some regulatory activity of the employment division and requiring some training and some of those aspects. I believe that legislation was either 99 or 2001.
Yeah. The reason, I want to see how it works. I also want to see what it costs. And I know that it's fairly recent, but under category of, you know, how programs develop, if you look at the amount of cost that we have for the whole department over the years, a whole government, we get lots of questions on where does it go and how does it work. And so when there's a new program that gets developed, it often doesn't stay at its initial intention, but the goal of doing good expands as time goes on. Okay, thank
you. And Mr. Chair, I would, in terms of this particular performance measure, 2000 was our implementation of this of measuring and providing this enhanced rate. And I guess I would point out to you that while 25% may not be a huge percentage, it has grown 10% in these 4 years. And it is a fairly significant raw number. We have about 8,000 listed providers, active providers, that the department uses currently. So about 2,000 of those are meeting those higher standards of child care as a child care provider.
Thank you.
And if there are no other questions, then I will.
We're all done.
Trade places.
There is one.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. To make it a little more hands-on for us, could you possibly provide maybe two or three hypothetical family units, i.e., you know, a single mother with two children, a mother and father with two or three kids, and a single parent in school? Give us their income level. And tell us, as we go through here, and we look at all the programs, be it self-sufficiency, kind of give us a cumulative of where someone would be, so we could understand how a family who met the criteria, what their total level of funding might be if they met several of the requirements. So just a two or three family scenario would be really helpful.
Okay, we will do that.
One more addition to that. How about a married woman, two children, unemployed, in an abusive relationship?
Mm-hmm.
That'll cover a little bit more of what you do.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll move next to Sue Abrams, who's going to talk with us about the food stamp program.
There's therapy for that.
Welcome to our committee. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sue Abrams. I'm the administrator of the Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits. And I'm going to first talk about the food stamp program, and then, assuming we have any time, we'll move into prevention. As Jim Neely mentioned, the food stamp program is 100%. The program benefits are 100% federal funds. The administrative costs are shared equally between the state and the federal government. The program had its roots in 1939, but didn't become a mandated every state program until 1974. And then in 1977, the Food Stamp Act passed, and it's really the major driver of how the program works today. In 2002, it was reauthorized, and we did have some changes in that legislation that allowed us some flexibility to bring more people into the program. In terms of, and you can do the caseload slide, the target population is families and individuals with income below 185% of the federal poverty level. But in addition to income and a resource test, we also have a lot of non-financial eligibility requirements. They include things like student status, citizenship, immigration status, residency requirements, and work registration. And there are some additional ones. Those are the major ones. The benefit amounts are based on household size, income, and expenses. And that the average food stamp benefit per household is approximately $175 per month. And as Jim mentioned, the benefits now are delivered through the Oregon Trail Card, our electronic benefit transfer system.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I have several years ago, college students could get food stamps. Are they still able to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, they, if they meet certain requirements, and I don't have all those memorized, but some of them have to do with if they are getting certain kinds of federal financial assistance, if they have children. So there are requirements. Not all students can qualify.
Thank you.
What expense items do you consider as criteria when you are looking at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, the expenses are usually, there are some, depending on, you know, what your income is. If you have income, there's some work expenses. Usually household rent and utilities are considered if you have rent and utilities. For people who meet a certain age and disability criteria, there's medical expenses.
We can actually get a sheet, can't we? Just showing eligibility and
Mr. Chair, we can do that. Some, in fact, I think that was a question we already got from the committee, and we were looking at trying to give you a display of the self-sufficiency programs and a comparison of the different eligibility requirements.
That's right.
We're trying to make it simple and a one-pager, but since our volume of manuals around eligibility are about that thick, it's sometimes hard to condense that. But we are working on that.
Would you also send to us a breakdown showing the increase in costs? I mean, we're providing a tremendous increase in benefits, but since the state is also carrying half of the administration costs, I have no clue as to number of employees, the amount of money that is expended by Oregon to provide the 50% of administrative costs, or what's even composed, you know, the administrative cost, what's that composed of, what are the components to that? So could you see that we
Mr.
get
Chair,
that?
Yeah, we will.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be very helpful in all of these breakouts and the information that you bring forward to us. It's broad currently at a 50,000-foot level. It would be helpful if those brought back to us by counties so each one of us could see what its impact and implications are inside of their county. Like for me, for Marion, Polk County, I think that would be very helpful. And for Representative Hansen up in Multnomah County, it puts it into some context and some perspectives.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Each county,
computer can spit out a county breakdown, I would assume. If you know what the state, then we would know what the county.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we can provide caseload information. You know, actually, I think we can provide it by county. For sure we can provide it by our individual service delivery areas. Some of those have multiple counties. So I think we can do it that way, but I'll need to talk with our systems people.
Thank you. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that same vein, as we're talking about administrative costs, if I, it'd be helpful for me to see like caseload count per food stamp case manager, and how many food stamp cases are in processing centers, and how many are still being managed by case managers, and the number, because my sense is that as the number has grown, the number of employees hasn't kept in step with the caseload growth, and now we've got pretty incredible caseloads per employee.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I'm going to have to defer to other people but we'll look to see what information we can get around caseload and staffing.
We know that there's a request from the board for, I think 50 more employees a time or two ago to help assure that there were more case managers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on the staffing, that'll be discussed in a little more detail when we get into the program support and field staffing discussion. I think Wednesday or Thursday we'll get into that. And then, of course, we'll look at that in great detail when we get into phase two, because that's where a lot of the budgeted costs are in this area, is in the service delivery system.
Okay. Please continue.
Moving into which I don't know actually if I need to refer you to the pages. I believe it's page 6 of the performance measures, where we have the performance measures and outcomes for the food stamp program. And I think you did ask some questions around some of that. We have three measures, and the key performance measure is the ratio of Oregonians receiving food stamps to the estimated number of Oregonians living at or below poverty. And you did ask a question about that and why we use that instead of a percentage of poverty, and could the measure be changed? Well, yes, the measure could be changed. We actually did explore that option when we developed the measure, and some of the problems with that, in fact, was that it would really be less meaningful. Part of that problem being that the program serves many more people who are above the 100% of poverty, so we wouldn't have them in the measurement. We'd be leaving them out completely if we just looked at the number of people in poverty who are receiving food stamps. The other piece of that kind of adds complexity is, just because you're below the at 100% of poverty doesn't automatically make you eligible for the program. There's those other non-financial requirements that I talked about. At the federal level, which is actually a better measurement, but one that we're not able to do because we don't have the infrastructure to be able to assess this, they really do an assessment of the potentially eligible population that's out there in the country and in the states, and then they do a measurement compared to that potentially eligible and what percentage of those we're serving. When we look at that measurement for Oregon, we are like the top third or fourth state in the nation in terms of serving the potentially eligible. But unfortunately, like I said, we don't have the ability to be able to measure that at the state level. We don't have the capacity to do that kind of assessment. The other reason we went with the ratio is that we also wanted to be able to give our service delivery areas some information around this, and the poverty, this comparison or ratio, we're able to do by our service delivery area and also by a county.
So, you know, I would assume that there's still a substantial percentage of population who feel like it's not appropriate to go on to government assistance merely because they qualify. Is that factored in at all?
Well, Mr. Chair, there probably are people who would qualify but choose not to apply, but we don't have any way of assessing who those people are.
And so the goal is to assure or to work toward any family or individual who does qualify that they get this benefit.
Mr. Chair, the goal is, and we've actually worked with many of our advocacy partners around, as you can see, there was a point where the caseload, not just our caseloads, but around the country, dropped significantly. And we made a conscious effort to let people know about the program and to make it available to those families and individuals who could qualify and wanted to apply for the program. And we did, and I think in phase two we'll talk more about some of the things we did around that, but some of the reasons people were not coming on the program didn't have anything to do with them not wanting to apply, but the complexity of our application process. So we did streamline that.
Because it seems like the outcome measure ought to be assuring that people have sufficient food, not that they take advantage of government programs merely because they're there. I mean, those are, that's a little different.
And ultimately, these are sort of interim outcome measures. There's a benchmark, an Oregon benchmark around hunger, and we believe that this would be a piece of the strategy to help reduce hunger. But I was recently reading a report by Oregon State University. They were looking at why Oregon was one of the hungriest states in the nation and what were some of the contributors. And it's a very complex issue. But what they found is that for this state, even for people who you would assume would not be have a high hunger rate, like people who are employed, for some reason here and in Washington, the anomaly is that in all categories, we have more hungry than you would expect to see. But they weren't able to determine the reason. What they suggested is the next things we need to look at is how costs fit into that.
Well, it's interesting, and it won't take a lot of time on this right now because it's more philosophical, but if Oregon has one of the highest hunger rates, and yet we also are one of the most aggressive in helping to assure that our citizens are on government support, maybe there's a relationship, especially in light of our conversation earlier, that to qualify for these benefits, you have to make sure that you don't become a little bit more successful than your federal poverty level limits, whatever those are, or whatever the grant numbers are that we've set, you know, as far as what it takes to qualify to get these benefits, which we're widely promoting as being desirable to have. And so it'll be interesting to see if there can't be greater focus on self-sufficiency, which is, of course, your whole department, not merely qualifying to assure that you can get the benefits that the government pays out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of my concerns too is in this same area, if there's a stigma attached to food stamps, that keeps Oregonians that are actually hungry and in need of the program from signing up for them. And so I'm very pleased with the outreach work that you've done in trying to remove that. I think sometimes we have people that artificially constrain what the government services are that they use, when what we really need to be doing is promoting good nutrition, and nutrition for children, nutrition for pregnant mothers or pregnant women. These are the things that long term are going to have incredible health impacts and can make our society be a lot better. But if there's too much of a stigma attached to these programs, then some of the people that most need the help will deny themselves the help, self-screen themselves out from getting it, and it's a real
certainly
concern.
We taught our family to seek, if at all possible, to be independent and self-reliant and to have good nutrition, and I feel that that is probably in the best interest of all of Oregon, not merely to say that you focus on getting government benefits so that you can be healthy, but be that you be healthy and have nutrition and be successful and be self-sufficient without merely focusing on whether or not you're able to qualify and get government benefits. Senator Winner.
There is some discussion and there is some research that's going on as to trying to answer the question why. And one of the variables that is being discussed is the issue of the cost of affordable housing in Oregon. And if when you begin to, so you need to begin to take what it does cost to live for just some of the basics, and then you know, whether after you finish paying all these other bills, what's left. And I know that discussion is taking place. I understand from some of the things that I read that housing is right up there at the top as one of the major causes. And so it's not as, I think, as simple as we all kind of think. But there is something in Oregon and in Washington that's taking place, and that's one of the elements that's there. I think the other piece of it is that, and I they'll probably be before us, is looking at the definition of hunger. You know, it's, as you know, I started Oregon Food Share a lot of years ago, you know, trying to find a way of feeding individuals, because certainly no one should go hungry in this in America, not only Oregon. But I think those are some of the variables, as I'm beginning to hear, and as they begin to research what makes us different. And I think we need to know what makes us different. You know, what is taking place in Oregon and its Oregon's environment? Is it the cost of living? If it's housing, what are we doing with respect to housing that people can't afford to pay their rents, for example? So I just throw that out there because those
thank you. And I think that Representative Hanna's comment and question about jobs certainly applies as well, because if it all comes back to being self-sufficient means being able to have a good job and that you can
and
have a wage, family wage thing. That's right. And have the dignity, the self-confidence, the self-esteem that all comes with being able to do those things. And certainly we're grateful for all the focus that takes place in that area. I mean, in 1965, we had the declaration of war on poverty by President Johnson. Well, since then, we've spent over $6 trillion federally and billions of dollars in the state of Oregon. And so as you look at the results of the war on poverty, poverty's won. You know, I mean, we're still at 13.6% poverty after spending all of this money. And so maybe what we're doing is not working. And so we can either continue to do it, or we can work through all the experience, all the models that take place, and realize that there are successful solutions working somewhere. And if ours isn't as successful as we want, then maybe we could change our emphasis. And I don't know where that'll go or how we can do that, but I'm grateful for the input of all the experience that's here and the cross-section from the state that we have here to help see if there aren't things that can be done to increase our success at your goal of self-sufficiency. Okay, thank you.
And then the third performance measure is the food stamp error rate, which measures the accuracy in determining eligibility benefits, which is very important to us, and as you can see from the slide, that we have been pretty successful this last year. We have made a very concentrated effort in reducing the error rate, and it, we really credit needs to be given to our staff out there who are determining eligibility. We're providing some additional support centrally, but they've been doing the work, and we've been able to drop that error rate. I believe it's about 40% in just this last year, so we're feeling and at the same.
Excuse me, Representative. Oh.
I applaud that they've brought the error rate down. That's wonderful. If I'm doing the math, we're spending somewhere around $870 million on food stamps. Does that sound?
Oh.
Right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I don't have the figures right in front of me, but
Just bear with me. If 8% of the cases were wrong, I mean, if we didn't have their eligibility requirements correct, it would be $70 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that wouldn't be quite correct, because the error rate doesn't mean that people are ineligible. It means that we may have calculated their benefits incorrectly. They could have been calculated incorrectly and be off by $10. So it's not, you know, you can't, it's not, you know, it's not exact. And they may have been underpaid.
Go the other way.
Yeah.
Go the other way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I recognize that, but let me stay with this just for a minute.
Yeah.
Can we measure what the error rate is in terms of dollars, plus or minus? I mean, we know a percentage, but do we know the dollar amount?
Because Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I'll check on that if we can actually get the dollar rate for Oregon.
We've got 6 minutes left.
Just so you know, that we have to maintain a certain. There's a certain rate that states have to maintain, and you move into a penalty phase, and we don't want a penalty, because then the federal government, then the penal. It's substantial.
You mean percentage of employee of a population?
No, states have to maintain. They have a certain level, and we were at risk.
Of rate error.
Of rate error.
Oh, yes. Okay, yes.
And so we gave more staff so that we could bring that rate down.
Great. And we're glad we made the trend continue. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I agree with that. So since there's 5 minutes left, I'm pretty much done with the food stamp program unless you have any additional questions. I don't know if you want to move into the prevention area.
Yes, I think we should. We'll try to keep up with you.
For the prevention services, we have really two major areas. We have teen pregnancy prevention, and then we have the community safety net program. First one I'm going to talk about is the teen pregnancy prevention, which has several components. And historically, the state really has had efforts around teen pregnancy prevention since the 1970s. But around the mid-90s, 1990s, is when we really did a concentrated effort on coordinating our efforts and paying attention to the information and research that was out there around those kinds of strategies that really do make an impact. In 1996, Governor Kitzhaber convened a broad-based committee to develop the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Action Agenda, which is what we're still using today as kind of our blueprint, although we have modified it as new information comes out and as we have experience with it. Our efforts target youth aged 10 to 17. And the way the action agenda works is it's broken into seven different strategies, and we have subcommittees that kind of work on the detailed plans around developing those strategies. Most of the work happens in the local communities. We do a lot of work providing them with supports and technical information. Some of the kinds of things we do is, for example, we have a subcommittee that's providing services to young parents. And they represent about 20 to 25% of the teen births. So a young parent is very likely to have another child while they're a teen. And our efforts in this committee have been around helping to avoid that second pregnancy occurring while they're a teen. And so we were able to give some seed money to a group that works with these folks to develop what's called the Directions Guidebook, and have distributed it to all the teen parent programs around in the state. About half the programs are in schools and half of them are out-of-school programs. So it's that kind of effort that we do. So with a small amount of money, we're able to actually reach a lot of agencies and groups and organizations and local work in the community with information and strategies. So we kind of do the research and then we provide them with the information. And that's the action agenda specifically. And one of our subcommittee is around the absence education programs. And we were able, as a result of the TANF reauthorization, some money was put into that to fund abstinence education programs around the country. And in this state, we chose to put most of that money into what we call the STARS program, which is the Students Today Aren't Ready for Sex. It's a program that's delivered to middle school youth, sixth graders mainly, by the, high school youth, peer leaders. And what the department does is train the peer leaders, the team leaders, and we train the adult facilitators, who are most often the teachers in the classroom, to deliver that program. It's a five-session program that is aimed at helping build skills around media, to help youth become aware of how the media influences them, correcting some of the misconceptions about sexual behavior, and building refusal skills. And we have we've had several evaluations of that program, but our most recent one we were able to do with a control group, and we feel really good about the outcomes that we found in that, and that for sixth graders, we are impacting those things that we believe need to be impacted to make a difference, and that is their knowledge, attitude, intentions, and skills engaging in early sexual behavior. We also have the AmeriCorps RAP program. That's a federal grant program. We have we're able to fund about 20 AmeriCorps members around the state. And they provide, again, they're there in the local community to provide technical assistance and resources based on whatever that local community would like to see them doing over the period of the grant. And it's done through a competitive process where communities apply to have a member.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the valuable information you provided today.
And before we close, Senator Bates.
I just got to put a plug in with the STARS program because I can't control myself. I'm on their board, and this is a mentoring program for high school students come down to junior high and middle schools. And they've had a great impact in telling kids they don't need to have sex. And that's their basic, it's a basic abstinence program. They do a great job, and I appreciate the effort they've done. It's not the whole answer to why this pregnancy rate's going down, but it's part of it. So for the amount of money we put into it, we get a lot out of it. Thanks.
Particularly valuable for those that can't control themselves.
They should probably put me through the program for me.
We'll be adjourning at this time. Thank you very much.